After slavery, African Americans comprised over 40% of the population of the South, and by constitutional right, would have most likely assumed upwards of 40% of legislative, judicial, and executive posts in the 11 states which comprised the Confederacy. What they received was much less. After enjoying constitutional rights for a limited time, Southern states who feared the strength of their numbers instituted a system of oppression that forced 6 million of them to flee to the West, Midwest, and Northeastern states during what was called the Great Migration, circa 1900 to 1970. Today, 36 million black people crowd into 10,000 square miles, or a landmass the size of Maryland, instead of enjoying the vast 800,000 square miles of the Confederate South. More importantly, they lost constitutional powers, which are enjoyed by the states seeking instead constitutional rights or civil rights. Today, we discuss or revisit Delkism, a regional bloc of black-controlled states in America, on Talk Unchained. And good evening to my audience on American Muslim 360 on Blog Talk Radio. I am your host, Marlon Aldridge. Of course, I want to know what you think about this plan. The call-in number is 515-605-9891. Again, that's 515-605-9891. Press 1 to get in the queue if you have questions. And make sure that your speaker phones are turned off, that you are not listening to the show on another device, as this will produce an echo in the podcast. And of course, all of our podcasts are archived for your future listening enjoyment. And before we begin to talk about the Delk Plan, what is it's commonly referred to, I want to give you some economic facts about slavery as a context. In 1860, slaves represented about 16% of the total household assets. That is all the wealth in the entire country, which in today's terms is a stunning $10 trillion. And in 1860, slaves as property were worth more than all the banks, factories, and railroads in the country put together, says Civil War historian Eric Foner. Now think what would happen if you liquidated the banks, factories, and railroads with no competition. So that sets the context for our conversation today. To add a little bit more information about that, the conflict, this is a quote from South Carolina commissioner in Virginia, who was speaking to a crowd February 1861. He says, "The conflict between slavery and non-slavery is a conflict for life and death." These are quotes. Now, the South cannot exist without African slavery. Now, let's get into the plan, having talked about or at least given us a context as to why this may or may not make sense. Frederick Delk, whom I believe is from Atlanta, reformulated this plan, first conceived by the Malcolm X Society and the Group on Advanced Leadership for the Republic of New Africa on March 31st, 1968. Now, I'm going to be quoting from his website. A lot of the source material is from AfricanAmericanHomeland.com. AfricanAmericanHomeland.com. You can find most of this information. Of course, I'm going to supplement some of it. But this is an expansion of the original five states, which were Louisiana, Mississippi, Alabama, Georgia, South Carolina, and black majority counties adjacent to these areas in Arkansas, Texas, Tennessee, Florida, and North Carolina. The original proposal for the Republic of New Africa was for total independence from the United States of America. The African American homeland states isn't an independent nation. It is a collaboration between a regional bloc of states to achieve a common purpose with no more or less rights or powers. as granted under the 10th Amendment to the United States Constitution than any other states in the United States of America. So it needs to be understood. We're not talking about what some groups have been urging, black nationalism, for many years, even till this day. They want total independence. Groups like the Nation of Islam advocate total independence from the United States. And so what we're going to do here today is that we're going to do a compare, in a way we're going to do a compare and contrast, and I'd like you to participate with me. What is the likelihood of us, of black people, actually strategically placing ourselves in all of the voting districts of 8 contiguous states? And we'll talk about what those states are in a minute. And of course, they're going to be in the South. And then, of course, we want to compare and contrast that to actually achieving an independent country within the United States. The African American homeland states, or the 8 states' southern region, will have an unwritten or verbal compact economic community of 8 southern states. He referred to it as the ECESS, the Economic Community of 8 Southern States. Its mission is to promote security, economic, and political cooperation across the 8 states' southern region. And so there is a point of demarcation between the two, regionalism versus independence. With these block of 8 states, we still remain a part of the United States. The hope is that we take control of the legislative, judicial, and executive branches within these 8 states. It's important to recognize that. We're talking about the governor's office all the way down to the local level, where we have the mayor's offices, of course, the county offices, any political subdivision within the state. If we strategically place ourselves in such a way where we become the majority in these voting districts, then, of course, we're able to assume the leadership post in those particular areas. What states are we talking about? We're talking about Georgia, Mississippi, Louisiana, Arkansas, South Carolina, Alabama, North Carolina, and Tennessee. And first of all, why these particular states? These states, for the most part, have large percentages of blacks, for number one. And then number two, the states as a whole don't have many people. Those 8 states combined, we're looking at eligible voters now, because those would be really all that matter, up 34.5 million, and blacks make up 26% of those states already. And so in terms of congressional districts controlled by blacks, let's go over that right quick to sort of give you an idea. In Georgia, and I'm not sure how current some of this information is, Georgia has a potential 14 congressional seats. They control 14 of them. Mississippi has 4 congressional districts. They control, the blacks control 1. Louisiana, 1 of 6. Arkansas, none. They have 4 congressional districts. South Carolina has 7. Blacks control 1. Alabama has 7, blacks control 1. North Carolina has 13, of which blacks control 2. And Tennessee has 9, of which blacks control 1. So we're looking at 11 of 64 total congressional districts are controlled by blacks. Now, there is the potentiality that we could control all 64. And if my numbers are correct, currently, we control about 42, so we're looking at a gain of about 22 if we could actually actualize this plan. Now, this is not counting the Senate. So if we controlled 8 states and we sent 2 black senators, senators from each state, that would be a total of 16 senators. So we're looking at a rise of congressional power, and in the House of Representatives, and we only have two currently, if I'm not mistaken, we only have two senators in Congress right now. So these would be big gains from a congressional standpoint, and we can imagine what would happen if we voted as a block in both the House and the Senate. We could, in effect, shut both of those branches down or position ourselves in such a way so that either party would have to come through us in order to get any type of legislation passed. Think about that now. There's only 100 representatives in the Senate. And so 16, that would be a big deal, regardless of what the particular issues are. We would be able to command at least an ear, and would have a considerable amount of power in trying to get legislation passed. So these are some of the major differences of the plan. Of course, we're going to go, what would be some of the powers? And see, to me, this is important. I talk about this a lot. We've heard, or at least many of us would say, that I don't believe in such a thing. Whites don't have privilege. Whites have constitutional powers. So they're able to dictate everything that they have the ability to dictate in terms of legislation, in terms of apportioning resources, in terms of appointments. And we'll talk more about what are some of the things that at the state level on down, the governor's mansion all the way down, we'll talk about some of the things that the state can do as opposed to what the federal government can do. We'll talk about that a little later. Of course, like I said, I'd like you to participate. We'd like to hear some of your questions and comments. And we've already provided the number for that, and I'll provide the number again later in the show. I think this is a very ambitious ideal. I think it's doable. But really, to be honest with you, I don't think that we would be subject to act unless the pressure from the majority is so great that we would have no other choice than to consider plan. We're not at that point now, but we know that it can happen because it's already happened. We talked about the Great Migration. We looked at over 6 million people fleeing from the South to the Midwest, to the West, and some of the other places that we had mentioned earlier. Blacks are, in effect, today crowded into 10,000 square miles. So we're looking at extreme population density. We're actually living on top of one another. And that 100,000 square miles, of which 36 million of us are crammed into, as I said earlier, is about the size of Maryland. So we all know when our space is pretty much inviolate, is violated. We're living on top of one another. So we can imagine that the crime rates are going to be high. Trying to manage that many people in such a small place is going to put many pressures upon any political body, but especially when we are not in control of those political bodies. So this is an opportunity for us to not only enjoy the Bill of Rights, but also for us to enjoy constitutional powers delegated to the federal government and to the states, and then, of course, all of the political subdivisions within the states. Let's give an idea. Let's describe this African-American homeland. Let's talk about that for a minute. We're looking at several major seaports on the Atlantic Ocean, Wilmington, Charleston, Savannah, and a few seaports access on the Gulf of Mexico. New Orleans, one of the largest and busiest seaports in the world. We're looking at seaports in Mobile, Alabama, and Biloxi, Mississippi, too. And, of course, some of these would have to be expanded. We'd have the opportunity to do that. We're looking at some major transportation routes, too, in terms of major highway access runs through the 8 states southern region, 7 interstate highways, interstates 10, 20, 40, 65, 75, 77, and 95. We're looking at the Mississippi River, which provides access to the Gulf of Mexico, New Orleans, and to the heartland of the cities of St. Louis, Davenport, Iowa, and Minneapolis, St. Paul. We're looking at an international airport in Atlanta. We're looking at a major railroad line, CSX, Union Pacific, and Norfolk Southern. I want you to imagine all of this. These are resources. The area has good soil for growing plants. We're looking at forest trees cover 60% of the 80-state southern region's total landmass. I want to say that one again, 60%. So this gives us an opportunity to be involved in forestry as well, and lumber, for instance. We have a long general coastline, 1,082 miles, with many sandy beaches on the Atlantic coast and the Gulf Coast, and modern infrastructures as well. And the total GSP, this is 2005, of the Economic Community of 8 Southern States, that was the name mentioned earlier, is $2.2 trillion. Let me say that again, $2.2 trillion. And if the 8 states southern region was an independent country, it would have the 10th largest economy in the world. 10th largest economy in the world. And 2012, the 8-state southern region collected about $300 billion in federal tax revenue, and this does not include $200 billion in extra payments the federal government transferred to the states, such as Medicare payments, welfare payments, Social Security payments, disability payments, jobless claims payments, federal infrastructure projects, federal government employees, including military personnel, federal government contractors, and other federal entitlements. How does this sound so far? We're looking at a huge economy here located in these areas, not to mention the National Guard, state militias, state defense forces, the Constitution of the United States. Article 1, Section 8 of the United States Constitution contains a series of militia clauses outlining the state's right to create militias. Of course, we'd have to have those to defend ourselves. We're looking at National Guard and Air Guard, and Air National Guard are under the control of the individual states, with the state governor acting as commander-in-chief. However, the president can activate the National Guard and place it under federal control, and National Guards are typically called into action by a state governor for officially declared emergency of the state, weather-related emergencies, civil unrest, terrorist attacks, and used for security details at state borders, airports, and seaports. And we know that Mississippi, Georgia, Louisiana, and South Carolina have active units. All of these don't have active units at these levels. And 6th in the world in electricity generation, 639,000 gigawatt hours. And this is more than Germany, Canada, France, Brazil, South Korea, the UK, and Mexico. Has 32 oil refineries, including 19 in Louisiana, which has 2 which are ranked largest in the world. So we're talking about natural resources and refining as well. Potentially 8 governors, 16 senators, and 66 Congress people. We're looking at a whole lot of power here. The African-American homeland provides the best opportunity for cohesion. All the states have shared borders, a complete contiguous state, in the same geographical area. Think about this now. With the Atlantic Ocean access will result in, so goes Delk, Fred Delk, unity, protection in numbers, shared cultural identity, shared geographical identity, shared political agenda, large, somewhat homogeneous consumer market, and shared economic strategy and social conformity. Sounds like a nation to me is what it sounds like, but not the hassle. We all know what would happen if we wanted to separate. We're looking at another war, and I don't think we are prepared for that. We are not prepared as a group to go with war with anyone, let alone the United States of America, which has the largest military in the world. What are some of the other points? Let's talk about the powers of the state. Now, this is going to be important. The powers of the state, number one, to regulate intrastate businesses, establish local governments, and under the right conditions, they can also disband local governments. We're talking about city governments and so forth. Of course, they conduct elections. They issue licenses, permits, and certificates. Take measures for public health and safety. Ratify amendments to the Constitution. Exert powers the Constitution does not delegate to the national government or prohibit the state from using. We're talking about the 10th Amendment, of course. They have the right to borrow money, issue bonds, charter banks and corporations, establish courts, build roads and transportation systems, make and enforce laws, take private property for public purposes with just compensation, and spend money for the general welfare. Why is this something that I'm even talking about? There are many problems within the African-American community that we would love to solve. The people are eager to solve. But we don't have the resources or the structure and in many times the authority to solve those problems. So having constitutional powers and all of the rights and authorities that I just mentioned would allow us to do that on a macroeconomic or a very large scale. It's important for us to understand that. And generally, other states which allow mistreatment of blacks may have their citizens banned from the African-American homeland states. This is some of the things that we have the potentiality of doing. If you mistreat blacks that are residents within the homeland states, let's say they're visiting states outside of the African-American homeland, then we can ban you from African-American homeland states. No extradition of citizens in the homeland states, which are viewed as no extradition of citizens in the homeland states to states, to other states which are viewed as hostile. Control of the three branches of state government. We've already mentioned that, the executive branch, the judicial branch, the legislative branch, not to mention all of the appointments. U.S. constitutional power is more vital than constitutional rights. Now, this is me speaking here. I'm a big proponent of this. Yes, we have constitutional rights. We have very limited constitutional powers. And only in those cases where we are the majority. And some of us would argue even where we are the majority, I'm thinking mainly about in some of these cities, we're still not able to get much done because the state has the right to overrule us where it has jurisdiction in particular issues. One of the things I'm thinking about, which here in the area that I'm from, Dayton, they have a majority black city commission. And one of the things that the city tried to do is that if you wanted to work for the city government, you had to live within the city. Well, state of Ohio overruled that. So that's an example of what I'm talking about. The state, if it has purview, does have the right to overrule the municipal governments. Now, let's do some imagining here. I want you to imagine the University of North Carolina, North Carolina State University, Clemson University, South Carolina, Georgia University, Georgia Tech, University of Alabama, Auburn University, Mississippi State University, University of Mississippi, Louisiana State University, University of Arkansas, University of Tennessee, University of Memphis are state-controlled institutions and are potentially 80% black students. Now, this is imagine, we're imagining now. Private universities. Let's name some of the private universities in these areas. Duke, Wake Forest, Emory, Tulane, Vanderbilt, and others will most likely conform to the new demographics and sell their assets to the state of black investors. So we're looking at taking they're probably going to want to flee, right? They're not going to want to be within this African-American homeland. They are most likely to flee. So they would be looking to sell these assets in order to flee. Most likely, that would be my guess. I think that's a pretty good contention or assumption. And he's also formulated an economic plan. Let's look at what this economic plan may entail. Land reform laws will be passed to redistribute land to those that want it. And, of course, we know in the early days of this American frontier, these territories, a lot of that was going on, especially in the South. If you were to purchase land, they would give you slaves. Can you imagine that? We had European immigrants coming to this country, purchasing land if they could afford it, and being given two male slaves for a certain number of acres. I can't remember what the acreage was, or one female slave, depending upon the acreage that you had purchased. So we have some of that going on, too, of course, without the slaves, I hope. And as a goal, 75% of the land would be owned by the state and local governments and black private citizens, while 80% of all farmland, ranches, and family forests in the state would be controlled by blacks. Now, I'm relooking at that, and that something doesn't seem right about those numbers. As a goal, let me read that again, make sure I'm reading that right. As a goal, 75% of the land would be owned by the state and local governments and black private citizens, while 80% of all farmland, ranches, and family forests in the state would be controlled by blacks. Okay, so we're still looking at some private enterprise from non-blacks there, but the majority would be controlled by blacks. And through the eight states' buyout plan of 100 million acres of farmland through the Southern Homestead Act. So we're looking at applying some of the laws which had existed prior to this potential African-American homeland, and 30% would be purchased by African-Americans at discounted prices. 50% of the most prime farmland would be sold at market prices to African-American investors. 20% would be given or purchased at steep discounts to the poorest black American families. So we have a tiered plan there, of course, giving everyone an opportunity to participate in land ownership. And to compete with multinational corporations located within these states, policies would be enacted so that blacks could compete. And, of course, that would be vital, that we are able to compete with the multinational corporations, because the truth be told, many of these multinational corporations make so much money and have so much wealth that they could dictate to these subdivisions within the state pretty much what to do. And we don't want to have a situation where multinational corporations are actually coming in to, say, a city, and because of its large size and wealth, being able to control what takes place in those particular cities. Of course, in these states, we have national franchises, and the national franchises would be given incentives to increase black franchisee ownership in the NFL, NBL, NBA, etc. Opportunities to participate in organized professional sports as well. And corporations will be given incentives to unbundle and sell local assets to black investors. Again, we're looking at some of these very large corporations are actually parent holders to many subsidiaries. So there's an opportunity to unbundle some of those subsidiaries and sell them off to black investors. The cost of doing business in the region would be kept competitive so that corporations do not leave the region. So we're not saying that we want the corporations to leave. So there's going to have to be some give and take there because, like I said, especially the large corporations, they employ a lot of people and have vast resources all over the world, as a matter of fact. Utility companies, natural monopolies, or critical infrastructures would be controlled by blacks. That would be important. And the new legislatures would consider repeal of current state laws and write new constitutions, especially for those laws that do not benefit us as a group. And reparations would be considered to repair the damage done by the past. We finally get, for instance, our 40 acres, less the mule, of course. I'm sure, well, I don't know. Some of you probably want that mule and sell it on eBay or something like that. I don't know. The African American Stock Exchange would be developed and capitalized by pensions, black-owned banks, and other private entities, including international investors. And the target capitalization is $1 trillion, which is equivalent to black GDP. That's current GDP for blacks. So we're looking at establishing our own stock exchange. And there's going to be a lot of pensions in the state. You can imagine that. The state, the publicly controlled institutions, the colleges, the universities, and things of that nature, the city governments and the county governments and things of that nature. There's going to be large pension plans there, and that money could be invested in asset management companies within those particular states. And a commodities exchange would also be developed for raw material and agricultural goods. So we're looking at setting up the same types of structures and systems as the majority has. That's very important. They've proven to work for them, so there's no reason to suspect that they would not work for us. I guess the only thing is that we'd have to adapt them in such a way to things that we value. I've noticed many times that we try to imitate what whites have done, but we do not value the things that they value given their history. They have a history of doing things a certain way. We have a history of doing things certain ways. So we would have to adapt those systems so that we make sure that we are valuing or we place value on the things that are most important to us. And I would hope that would be benign capitalism, not any of this monopolistic dog-eat-dog capitalism that we see going on now. And financial institutions must be created with target deposits of $2.5 trillion. So we're looking to get a lot of the money, not only from within the states, but, of course, we want to be able to get some of those money from abroad as well. We want to have reserves from other countries deposited in some of our financial institutions as well. We don't want to limit it to the eight-state region. We want the states' money to come from other institutions within the country and then outside of the country too. And imagine we're looking at the southern border. So we're looking at trade down in the Caribbean, South America, Central America, of course, Africa. And so we're looking to get some of that money invested in our institutions as well. Control of educational systems would be a major priority with the development of culturally appropriate curriculums and educational practices for black students. And I've sort of intimated that before. We're talking about our culture, right? We're talking about the things that we value. We're talking about our beliefs. We're talking about our attitudes. We're talking about the way that we go about solving problems. So many of these institutions are, if we were able to take control of them, they would look a little different than what they would look like under the current regime because of our difference in values and attitudes and so forth in our histories. Very important for us to understand that. I know many times blacks, we get upset at ourselves when many of us have attempted to model what whites are doing, and we find out that those systems and structures don't work for us. And the reason that they don't is because many of the values inherent in those systems are values that we really don't deem as important. So these systems would look a little different under us. It's we have to understand that. And I add that black students should be taught all subjects from a political perspective so that they have incentives to study hard. I've said that before on previous shows, that our educational system has to be not revised, it has to be dumped and created anew. And even subjects like math, I believe, can be taught politically. What do I mean by that? How can we use this math that we are studying to put us in an advantageous position to other groups? Flip side is that is how can this math be used to put black people at a disadvantage? I've always seen education as protection, as a form of defense. And this is how you begin to look at things when you look at these particular subjects from a political perspective. And I owe that to black psychology, looking at all of social activities from a political perspective. And, of course, from my standpoint, politics is not only about relations, not only about governance, but it's mainly about power. And we need more of it, not less. I can tell you that. Establishment of apprenticeship programs would also be paramount. We are suffering, especially these young black males, that, hey, they're not ready for college. And college isn't for everyone. As a matter of fact, there is a rule. There is a guidepost that says something to the effect that if you have 10 people, two of them would require a bachelor's degree, one of them would require higher than a bachelor's degree, and the rest of them would only acquire a two-year degree or some type of apprenticeship training. So one of the things in the African-American communities, we're pushing our students to go to college. There aren't enough jobs out here. If all of our children were to go to college, there aren't enough jobs to provide for all of them. Who is going to do the work of the plumbers, the carpenters, and all of the trades? We're going to need people to assume those positions as well. And to be honest with you, many of those trades make more money than people with college degrees. It's important for us to understand that. And I'm advocating capitalism would be maintained, none of this socialism stuff, I'm hoping. And we will do business with other countries like China, South Korea, Japan, Taiwan, Indonesia, the Philippines, India, United Arab Emirates, Saudi Arabia, Turkey. They love to do business with us. We're still part of the United States, but yet you got another cultural aspect of the United States that you could deal with instead of the majority. It'd be a whole lot different, I'd imagine. And there's a social plan, the most nonviolent, and some violent criminals have their records reviewed and potentially expunged or sealed. I don't know about the violent ones. That's what he's proposing. I didn't say that. And ex-felons who have served their time can vote. And many of us are pushing that now. Of course, we don't have the power to bring it to fruition because we are the minority. And I think it's important in this whole discussion here for us to understand that we are in the condition that we are in because we are not the majority. And we've already intimated what the powers are of the majority. They can affect the whole state with one law. They can affect the whole state. It's important for us to understand that. We're talking about Elkism, a regional bloc of black controlled states. We're going to take a quick station break, and then we're going to come back to continue our discussion. On Talk Unchained.
CWSC and American Muslim 360 invites you to promote your organization or event on the number one Islamic radio station in the nation. Affordable rates will allow you to promote your message and strengthen our national intelligentsia network. So contact Corporate Underwriting today at info@cwsc.us. Again, that's info@cwsc.us. Or dial 910-317-0297. Together we can remake the world.
We are back on Talk Unchained, continuing our discussion, Delkism, a regional bloc of black-controlled states in America. Two-parent families get preference in hiring, housing, land grants, small business loans, insurance, health care, etc. I think that's a novel idea. We know that black families have been decimated, and this is an opportunity for us to revalue black families. These are our primary institutions. These families are institutions. We need to revalue them. And that would be a great way for us to be able to do that. And how is this best achieved? Let's talk about that for a minute. Mass migration back to the 8-state region. We've already done it once, and we would have to move. Now, listen to this. We would have to move 20 million blacks back to these states to become the majority, but 24 million would be ideal for a super majority. Right now, we're looking at about 49 million blacks in the United States. Now, I'm going to be honest with you. That's a huge number of people. That's far more, over three times more than what migrated from the South. So we're looking at from a logistical standpoint, that would be a huge number. And, of course, it would have to happen over a large time frame, and there's an opportunity for the majority to adjust. And so that's one of the criticisms I have about the plan. And whoever has the most votes controls the state. We've already said that. But we live in a country in which the majority rules. I'm going to keep preaching that because I don't think most of us get it. And we're out here, we're doing a lot. We're politically active in all of this, and we're putting people in office. And we put one black person on the city council, and there's four seats. So they're one of four. Unless everyone else votes like them, they're going to get outvoted every time. And this is happening even to today. We look at our boards, nonprofit boards, the same thing. We're putting blacks on corporate boards. We're putting blacks on nonprofit boards, and they're the only persons there. And to be honest with you, there's no guarantees with a black person there because some black people aren't looking to be pushy. They aren't looking to assume the ranks of power. They aren't looking to lead. Many of them aren't looking to look out for the interests of black folks. So, you know, there are some negatives even to that. And we must control every part of each state, no exception. So we're talking about all political subdivisions within the state, from the state government. We're looking at the county. We're looking at the townships. We're looking at the villages. We're looking to control every part of the state, no exceptions. And whites who want to leave would be given just compensation for their land and assets. So we're not looking at taking people's properties like was done to us. And whites who want to stay are welcome. So it's not anything racist about this plan. Here's the only thing. He's suggesting, and I agree with this, and this is another negative critique, must be done in secret. That's not going to happen. That's not going to happen. So that's one of the negative criticisms I have about the plan. It's a great idea, but from a practical standpoint, there are some hurdles. Now, I believe hurdles can be overcome, though, so I'm not suggesting that these are things that can't be overcome. What are some other facts here? That's over 1 million blacks have graduated universities in the last 25 years. Now, what we're getting at here is we're going to have people that are able to run the state government and all the political subdivisions therein. We're going to have a qualified citizenry to be able to run these governments. 36 million black people live in an area of 10,000 square miles. I've already said that, or the size of Maryland. And every county in the eight-state region will be targeted, except counties with more than 60% black populations. And for counties with 70% or more black populations, some blacks will be encouraged to migrate to adjacent counties with much lower black populations. And the first migration wave of African Americans is eligible voters recruited from all over the country that want to live permanently in their new chosen county. Government corruption would be low because public servants are paid well and there is oversight by FBI, IRS, and other agencies. Well, that doesn't always work. We already know that doesn't always work. But we would assume for the collective that many of us are going to want to play ball. And it would be us as the electorate, it would be up to us as the electorate to make sure that we're putting the right people in office. And this eight-state region, eligible voters, we're looking at a difference between black and white in terms of voters, because it really be the voters that are going to really matter. We're looking at a difference of 15 million voters, 15 million more whites than blacks in these areas. And so that's why he suggested that at least 20 million or so to give us a majority, a substantial majority. And let's look at some of the places where African-Americans make up large percentages of the population. The District of Columbia, of course, we know was 50%. We're looking at Mississippi now. This is probably the largest, 37.3%. That's, Louisiana, 32.4%, Georgia, 31.4%, Maryland, 30.1%, South Carolina, 28.48%, Alabama, 26%, North Carolina, 21%, Delaware, about 21%, Virginia, 19.9%, Tennessee, 16%, or close to 17%, Florida, 15.9%. Now, of course, he didn't suggest places like Florida, because those are just too many people there. That's a whole lot of people, and you're looking at a total population of about 18 million. There's no way you're going to majority in states like Florida, because those populations are just too large in those particular states. Let's look at some of the federal spending to the states in billions of dollars. Now, this was 2013. Alabama, we're looking at retirement benefits of about $21 billion. Now, Arkansas, close to $12 billion. This is retirement benefits now. Georgia, about $32 billion. Louisiana, about $15 billion. Mississippi, about $11 billion. North Carolina, $36 billion. South Carolina, about $19 billion. Tennessee, $24 billion. We're looking at $170 billion in terms of retirement benefits. Non-retirement benefits, $131 billion. We're looking at $66 billion in grants, $45 billion in contracts, and $46 billion in salaries and wages. So that's a total. This is federal spending now in the states. So we're looking at $460 billion. So it's important for us to understand that not only will we collect revenues from each state, but we will also collect revenues from the federal government as well, in terms of taxes and things of that nature. Now, this is the money that the federal governments are spending within the states. But many times, that money's turned over to the states to manage those particular programs. And retirement benefits payments to individuals include Social Security retirement, survivor and disability payments, veterans benefits, and other federal retirement and disability payments. Social Security accounts for about 3/4 of these payments. Non-retirement benefit payments to individuals include Medicare benefits, food assistance, unemployment insurance payments, student financial aid, and other assistance payments. Medicare accounts for nearly 2/3 of these payments. Grants include funding to state and local governments for a variety of program areas such as healthcare, transportation, education, and housing, as well as funding for individuals and other non-federal entities such as research grants. Colleges and universities are going to play a part in that. Medicaid grants to states account for about half of all federal grants. So this Medicaid and this Medicare, those are huge federal programs. And we're talking about contracts for purchases of goods and services, from military and medical equipment to information technology and catering services. Of course, our black businesses would get a large share of that, of those expenditures. Defense purchases account for more than half of federal contracts. So we're looking at a lot of employment, new employment associated with that as well. And salaries and wages for federal employees, roughly 2/3 of this spending is for civilians and 1/3 is for military personnel. So we got a lot of things going on here. We're at the end of our show. I'd like to get at least a few calls in to see what we are thinking about this plan. I did want to say that it's a very well put together plan. In terms of, they would have to be, number one, we would have to value such a plan. Again, many times we come up with all kinds of plans, and many times the things that we put in those plans, the majority of us do not value them. So it's like trying to get someone to do something that you know is beneficial, but if they don't value it, they're not going to do it. And so this is another criticism, is that I don't think black people, are the majority of us, are in a place where we want to be, for the most part, disassociated from whites. We've been groomed to be dependent upon whites. And this is me talking now. I'd like to know if what some of you think about that. So this is another criticism I have of the plan, is that I don't think we value it, and I think most of us would choose to stay right where we are. The only scenario I can see, this government tends to do what it is doing now, if it continues on its current trajectory, we're going to have a more right-wing government. And Trump was an indication of that. And, of course, we already see what Jeff Beauregard Sessions is doing. I want to take a call here. Caller from 504. Caller from 504. I'd like you to state your name, if you'd like, and where you're calling from. Caller from 504.
Assalamu alaikum. You better be
Wa alaikum
salam. Be
yes, sir.
It's I think girl down to this, you know, this is my play on it, right? That it'd be easy for us to deal with the bird in the hand is better than two in the bushes. And basically that's the thought that I've heard a lot of times. But I look at it as being an excuse, something to say. But the people don't want to get all that money because they're scared. Afraid that they might lose it.
Yes, sir.
So it's yeah.
So you don't think that the majority of black folks would agree to such a plan? Are you still there, Mr. Bilal? Okay, looks like he got cut off there. And so, well, we're at the end of the show. I'd like to thank our audience for your thoughtful questions and comments. And if you'd like to listen to past episodes of Talk Unchained, just visit blogtalkradio.com/AmericanMuslim360 and search for Talk Unchained or Marlon Aldridge among the on-demand episodes or in the search box near the top of the webpage. I'd like to send a more informative, thought-provoking broadcast on AM360 tomorrow morning starting at 7 a.m. Eastern Standard Time for critical issues with solutions, money sense, and a new day for al-Islam. This is Marlon Aldridge. I welcome you back next Wednesday and each Wednesday at 9 p.m. Eastern Standard Time for HBCUs and their importance in the civil rights movement. We're talking about historically black colleges and university and their importance in the civil rights movement with Professor Vanya Lewis. I want you to spread the word about the show and follow me on Facebook. Until next time, peace be unto you. Assalamu alaikum.